I will sing, O Most High, praises to thy name with my whole heart, and proclaim thy wonders great. I will rejoice and exult in thee, my foes fall at thy sight, for thou hast maintained my cause and my cry. Hell will judge from his throne, he shall remain forevermore. Hell will rule uprightly, judge the world in righteousness. The breath to feed him, he will to them a refuge be. For Adonai will not forget those who put their trust and confidence in him. To Adon sing his praise, declare his works to all nations. El Most High in Zion dwells, he will not forget his people. They declare his great works, and he will not forget their cry. Rise, Adon, put them all in fear, all the nations that forget that thou art El. Judge them, Adon, in thy sight, let the nations know
they are but men. All right, thank you for that. Let the nations know they are but men. We thank Elohim that in the time, as we all often pray during our prayer time on Fridays, when we pray about government and seeing what the world is doing, what the nations are doing, that's so sad and sometimes frightening and disconcerting. We are grateful that Elohim is Elohim, even as our brother was praying earlier today, and as we all know, and that we can trust him to keep us focused, safe, to serve him, so that when the time of our translation comes from this dark world into his everlasting kingdom, we will have that done for us without any fears or concerns. We thank him that he will keep us safe. We thank him that he is our dwelling place, as our brother Gene read, dear, and everything else that we was said today concerning him. Today we will continue in the book of Acts. We will try to finish the book of Acts today, I hope. Beginning from we're at Acts chapter 18, we will continue with verse 18 and hopefully conclude verse 28. Today is the second day of the month, according to our understanding of the calendar. If time permits, we may cover a little bit of, go over some things in relation to the month. We did that yesterday. But so we'll see what we can do today. But our main focus will be trying to finish the book of Acts, Acts chapter 18, I should say, today. So let's proceed with Acts chapter 18. Beginning with verse 18. And Paul, Acts chapter 18, verse 18, and Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren and sailed thence into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila, having shorn his head in Cenchrea, for he had a vow. And he came to Ephesus and left them there, but he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they desired him to tarry longer with them, he consented not, but bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that comes in Jerusalem, but I will return again unto you, if Elohim will. He sailed from Ephesus. And when he had landed at Caesarea, and gone up and saluted the congregation, he went down to Antioch. And after he had spent some time there, departed and went over all the country of Galatia and Phrygia in order, strengthening all the disciples. Verse 24. And a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in scriptures, came to Ephesus. This man was instructed in the way of the eternal, and being fervent in the spirit, he spake and taught diligently the things of the sovereign, knowing only the baptism of John. And he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him unto them, and expounded unto him the way of Elohim more perfectly. And when he was disposed to pass into Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him, who when he was come helped them much which had believed through grace. For he mightily convinced the Jews, and that publicly, showing by the scriptures that Yeshua was Messiah. Yeshua, the Savior, was the elect one. Okay, thank you. Let's start from verse 18. So we saw Paul, it says, after this, after what? After his experience in Achaia, which was part of Corinth, which was, as we learned, was a center of administration in Corinth. In other words, of legal matters. And Gallio was the deputy or proconsul there. And he, as we saw, he, while the Jews, those Jews who opposed, there were Jews that appreciated Paul, loved Paul, and believed, of course. Paul was a Jew, of course. You know, we don't need to say that. But those Jews that opposed Paul accused him, but Gallio would not have anything to do with that. And one thing I didn't mention, and you all probably know, is that Rome allowed freedom of individual faith, of belief. You know, so they did not interfere with that. They allowed as much autonomy or as much freedom for the nations to do as they wish, as long as they followed the Roman peace and gave in their and paid their taxes and kept peace, basically. In most cases, that's what it was. So here we see Gallio was not going to try Paul for any of this. And so he drove out those who accused him. So after this, is when Paul tarried there yet a good while and then took his leave. So he left after all of this. He left and went to Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila with him. So it says, having shorn his head in Cancria, for he had a vow. So we don't have an account of the vow. We don't know what it's about, but it happened at some point, I guess, while he was in on his way to Syria. He had a vow. Now, while we don't know what the vow was about, but the fact that it says he shaved his head points to the Nazarite vow. In Numbers chapter 6, so it's just, what is the Nazarite vow? Just quickly, Numbers chapter 6, let me turn there. We read about the Nazarite. The Nazarite vow is actually introduced to us in Numbers chapter 6 and described a bit. And of course, we know Samson was a Nazarite. There were others. So it says here in Numbers chapter 6, verse 1, and the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves. So that's good. I've had people ask me, do women do Nazarite vows? And I wasn't sure, but now I'm reminded, yes, it's either male or female. when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Eternal, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar or wine, or vinegar or strong drink, neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat moist grapes or dry. So there's no eating of grapes whatsoever. In all the days of this separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. And the days of the vow of his separation, there shall no razor come upon his head until the days be fulfilled, in the which he separated himself unto the Eternal. He shall be holy, and shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow, all the days that he separates himself unto the Eternal. He shall come at no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father, or for his mother, for his brother, or for his sister when they die, because the consecration of his Elohim is upon his head. And all the days of his separation, he is holy unto the Eternal. And so you could read more about this, but it was really a strict vow. So you could not even concern yourself, physically engage yourself, touch any dead body, even if it was that of your own parent. It's not to be done. So let's see. And if any man die very suddenly by him, and he hath defiled, verse 9, and defiled the head of his consecration, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day shall he shave. And on the eighth day he shall bring two turtles and two young pigeons to the priest to the door of the tabernacle congregation. And the priest shall offer the one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make an atonement for him, for that he sin by the dead, and shall hallow his head that same day. Let me just say something. I wasn't even going to think along those lines, but this gives so much insight in what sin is and how Elohim thinks. You know, that's why it's so important to put the mind of Messiah on, and because if people could see how the law really is and what Elohim, I think people would be maybe a little less judgmental, more humble, including myself, all of us. So it says here in verse 9 that if a man die very suddenly by him, in other words, of no fault, it's not his fault, it's suddenly, he didn't know, the person just dies, that is considered of as a sin. Do you see that with this vow? And the verse 11 says, and the priest shall offer one sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make an atonement for him, for that he sinned by the dead, and shall hallow his head that same day. And he shall consecrate unto the Eternal the days of his separation, shall bring a lamb of the first year for a trespass offering, but the days that were before shall be lost, because his separation was defiled. Could you imagine that? All of whatever days of the vow, done, useless now. It's useless. It's lost. The fact that he got defiled by a dead person, unawares, unplanned, it's accounted to the person who made this vow as a sin. He had to go through a process of being atonement. Why? Because for that he sinned by the dead, and shall hallow his head that same day. So that's how serious the law was. So when you see Paul and others in the New Testament are saying how difficult it really was a very difficult thing. There's no controlling. There's nothing here. There's no leeway. Oh, this was an accident. And that's why we need to, consider with Elohim what he means by sin. Sin is simply what is wrong. Sin is simply missing the mark. No excuse, nothing. The only excuse we can get is from him. you want to understand, because something he taught me when I was much even younger is that when we sin, when we hurt someone, do something wrong, we may say sorry. It doesn't fix it. You know, it cannot fix what we did by just saying sorry. That, so it's a reality. You want to understand, we can try to mend hurt feelings whatsoever. We could try to make, what's the word? We could try to repay, correct for our sins, make amendments, just do whatever we can to fix the problem. But once we create that type of a problem involving, especially when it involves others, we could barely fix it. Because the harm was done, we're just putting something in place of the harm. But the harm was done. But here, when the person was defiled, as it says in verse 12, but the days that were before shall be lost because his separation was defiled. This, so it's lost. All the efforts that were done before, useless. You got to start over with the Nazarite vow. Verse 13 says, and this is the law of the Nazarite vow. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall be brought unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And so on and so on. I'm not going to read the rest, but I just wanted, but do read it so we could understand what the law is. And when Yeshua says, do not make a vow at all. And here we see, surprisingly, I'm really surprised, Paul made of a vow. But Yeshua says, if you make a vow, what? You must keep it. But he counsels us, don't make any vows. So this is one thing that will help us understand a little bit going forward some of the situations we will read in the other chapters involving Paul's mission, involving especially Paul going to Jerusalem and some of the things that went on. This might give us insight. And what insight am I saying? Paul is a person. He is inspired by Elohim, but like everyone else, he can make decisions that are not necessarily the best. Why do I say this? Simply, he made a vow. What did Yeshua say? Do not vow. But if you make a vow, you shall keep it. Now, thankfully, I'm glad that Paul was able to fulfill his vow. But it's not necessary to make a vow. But Elohim allows all these things for our instruction. So everything you see a person does, who do we filter it to? Through Messiah, through the words of Messiah. So he had a vow, and he shaved his head in Cancrea, for he had a vow. So let's move on from there. And he came to Ephesus and left them there. But he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. So again, as we've seen over and over, wherever Paul goes, and I'm sure it was the practice of the others, where do they go first? The synagogue of the Jews, right? And they desired him, and to do what? To reason with them. He didn't go there just to fellowship as if everything is okay. He didn't do that. He went to reason with them, to proclaim the good news so that they may know that the Messiah came, had to suffer. He brought that forth, and he demonstrated that the Messiah had to suffer as he has done before. Die and rise again. Had to come in the flesh, suffer, die, and rise again. That's what he had to teach the Jews. To the Gentiles, of course, he had to teach much more. He had to give them the knowledge of Elohim if they didn't have it. Have them learn to abandon all the other false things. Teach them the ways of Elohim and tell them about Messiah. So it's a little bit more involved when you're dealing with people who are not at all believers, do not have the knowledge of Elohim. Okay, let's move forward. So he reasoned with the Yehudim, reasoned, not argued, not pushing, reason. And verse 20, when they desired him to tarry longer, he consented not. So they wanted him to stay longer. Paul was focused. He had a mission. He was purpose. He's not there to please men for men's sake. Not that he's not friendly, but he's there because he loves, and he has a lot to do. So he has to stay focused. He went there. He knows his job. He doesn't have to be told to go into the synagogue. You understand? And we too, we have to know our job. We have to know the structure of the body of Messiah. We have to know when we see a problem, that we don't need to be told, all hands on deck, put your hand there to fix it. We don't need to be told that if we are indeed his people. We need to know that's automatic. Hey, there's a problem here. The body is, the congregation of it is like a body. So when there's a problem, all rush to help fix that problem as much as possible. And again, I say this a lot. Unity in the body has been a big problem for a long time. For a long time. And not too many have rushed to try to do, but that is the priority, because Messiah wants his body united and fixed and tightly united. So that is a priority for us, that the body of Messiah must be reunited. So we see here in verse 20 of Acts chapter 18 how they desired Paul to stay longer with them, but he consented not. Why? Because he was focused. He had a mission to accomplish. He knew what it was that needed to be done, and he would not be detained. So we have to know what it is to be done and not allow our minds to not be able to prioritize things. We have to look at the body of Messiah, know what the priorities are, and not do just what we want to do or what seems convenient. Like I've said to people, what's the point of focusing on putting beautiful wooden floors, polished floors, in a room where the roof is broken and leaking? That it doesn't make sense. Of course, a nice, beautiful floor is a nice thing to have. But what's the point of doing that if the roof is leaking and the floor is going to get damaged? So if the body of Messiah is not united, what is the point of doing all of these things? It has none effect. If that's the point. So that's what I'm saying. The body has to come together first. Then everything will have its effect, the proper effect, because the effects, the teachings, the doctrines have to be conveyed at once, not here and there and separate and diluted by the time it reaches someone else. So it's a priority for the body of Messiah to get together, and so it should be a priority of each member of the body to understand that's the priority, because we could, as until the body is united, everything's going to kind of fall on deaf ears, except for the cliques here and the cliques there and all these different cliques of groups that are satisfied in their own little corner but not remembering Messiah's prayer in John 17. So going back to here, so they desired him to tarry. They wanted him to do something other than he needed to do. He would not. He did what he needed to do with them. Now he was moving on. So he bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that comes to Jerusalem, but I will return again unto you if Elohim wills. And he sailed unto Ephesus. This feast is probably Pentecost, if I recall, but as we continue, I'm sure we'll see some light, find some light as to exactly what this feast was. So then he sailed from Ephesus, he reached Caesarea and went up. And what did he do? He didn't need to be told. There's a congregation there. He went and he greeted the congregation. Did he just stop and hello and walk to it? No. He went in.
It says he greeted them, but what does greeting mean? I'm sure he spoke with them. He fellowshipped a little bit with them. But you don't just pass a congregation of Elohim and walk on. It doesn't make sense. That's to show you the unity that was there. How everything was one organization. This wasn't someone else's ministry. This congregation in Kaiser was not someone else's ministry. There's no such thing as this is his ministry, her ministry, brother so-and-so's ministry. No such thing in the congregation of Elohim. Because the congregation and the ministers, everything going on, the body belong to one person, Messiah. And so wherever there was a congregation of Elohim, all the brethren were involved. All the brethren supported each other, no matter how far, how distant they were physically. So he saluted them and went down to Antioch. And he... And after he spent some time there, what did he do? He went over all the country of Galatia, Phrygia, in order. So in some specific order, in order. And what did he do there? He strengthened all the disciples. Can any of us go into just any other congregate, so-called group or ministry and speak and do? No, because we're not united. It's supposed to be the body of Messiah, but no. But here you see Paul goes into these countries, Galatia and Phrygia, and he strengthens all the disciples there. Let's continue. Let's try to finish. And a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria. Now, Apollos, this is another thing about Hebrew to me, that when I read these things in the scriptures, it stands out boldly. A certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. Do you notice his name is Apollos? Apollos! But yet, there are people that are arguing over pagan words. That's their idea. It's not what Messiah thinks. Because the word Apollos is nothing unclean about it. The word Apollos is just a Greek word, but yet it's applied to a Greek, it's also applied to a Greek myth. The fact that a word is applied to a Greek myth doesn't make the word a bad word. Okay? Just like the word theos in the Greek. It's in the Septuagint, which is a translation of what we would call the Old Testament. That's the word that's there, theos. Not a bad word. We have to stop listening to these lies. The people had no issues with him being called Apollos. Neither did Elohim, obviously, because he was mighty. If Elohim had an issue with that, certainly he would have not enabled Apollos to be such a powerful servant of his. We have to learn to think when we read the scriptures, and if you go back to the Old Testament, you will see similar things. So, yes, Hebrew is good. If we know what we're doing and we're using it for love and to better understand the scriptures rather than tearing other people down and making silly conclusions like if you have a Greek name or if you say a Greek word, it's a bad thing. All of that are just... Those things are not true. Now, if you call a person Zeus, certain things are inappropriate when there are pronouns. When there are pronouns that are specifically tied to something pagan, yes. But not every Greek word is a bad word. Greek was created by Elohim. It's a language he created. It wasn't created by man. Remember the Tower of Babel? Elohim is the one who who did that. So you see here, a Jew named Apollos, born of Alexander, and this is why Peter, Kephas, had the name Petros. I mean, or I forgot the, but he had a Greek version of the word that we have Peter. I don't know if it's Petros or whichever it is. I don't recall at this time. But he also had a Greek name too. And so many others. So this also Iesus for Yeshua for instance. Iesus is not a new word. That word existed long before Messiah came to earth as a person. Because in the Septuagint, that's what's there. And in ancient Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem, first century, they use the Septuagint. Especially in the foreign lands, in the foreign synagogues. They were not speaking Hebrew. They were not speaking a mixture of Greek and Hebrew like we see today, where people are just like using this mixture of languages in such a way, especially when they don't really know the language, they butcher the Hebrew words. It's hard to listen. It's hard to listen to because it's terrible because they butcher the words. They apply them with the English in a way it makes no sense. That's not beneficial, and it does not make the congregation of Elohim, the servants, look proper when we do that. We have to be very careful that we know what it is we are doing. So we see here Apollos, there were no issues with him having this name. So it says this man was instructed in the way of the sovereign, and he was fervent in spirit and spake and taught diligently the things of the sovereign, but he only knew the baptism of John. Look at all these years that have passed, but we have people that only know the baptism of John. But thank goodness, as he began to speak boldly, Aquila and Priscilla had heard. They took him unto them and taught him, explained more accurately the way of Elohim, more perfectly to him. So he was teachable. As eloquent, as great as this man was, he was teachable. And look, did he know Priscilla? Did he know Aquila? This is the mind of Messiah. This mind driven for unity. He didn't say, who are you or so-and-so? No. The Spirit in them, the Spirit guided, the Spirit was orchestrating this, even though it's not mentioned here. So that now this eloquent Apollos can better understand the way of Elohim. And when he was disposed to pass into Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him. To receive who? Apollos. So he was going to go to Achaia. Remember, Achaia was where Paul was, where they were going to trying to judge him with Gallio, as we read in verses 12 to 17. So he intends, or Apollos intends, to go to Achaia. But what do the brethren do? Do this? Okay, that's your choice. You're no, they wrote. They wrote a letter ahead of his travels to the disciples in that region. To do what? To receive him. Do you see the unity? Do you see the efforts? People, it's working as a body here. He's not going to go and just go. The brethren that are around him are helping him, supporting his efforts, because they are one. They didn't say, oh, that's Apollos. That's his business. That's his work. We have our own things. No, it's a body. And wherever the brethren were, they were aware of each other, they loved each other, they supported each other. They were ready to do things for each other. They didn't need to ask, what do we see today? And this is why I said the priority is to get this house in order, is to get the body of Messiah in order. Like I said, don't be afraid, because many will say no, but some, or many, or even more, might say yes. It depends. But we need to do this during this generation, because Elohim knows from generation to generation those who are his, and he expects us to fix the problems in our generation. He expects that of us. Let's try to finish. So the brethren wrote and exhorting the disciples to receive him, who when he was come, helped them much which had believed through grace. So he went and he helped the brethren in Achaia, which had believed through grace, through the work of Paul and Aquila and Priscilla before that, while Paul was there, right? Or even before, because when Paul arrived there, as we saw in verse 7, there was Justus who worshipped Elohim, and plus there was Crispus who believed on the Lord with all his house, right? So the faith was moving, but the body was very supportive of each other, very unified. There was no, who are you? I don't know you. Well, that's your work. I'm doing this and you're doing that. No, it was none of that. It was united, not in words only, but in action. And he helped them much, not a little, much, which had believed through grace. For he mightily, not just a little, mightily convinced, refuted the Jews. And that publicly, not in secret, he did it openly. Why openly? So that it will go for the record. So that there will be no miscommunication of what was happening or why. It's done openly so it could be witnessed by all. So that the truth could be established, that none can say it was this or that, but all would need to testify of the truth unless they're false witnesses. So showing by the scriptures that Yeshua was Messiah. Okay? So that's what Apollos did. And the unity of the body enabled him to do all of this. They received him. He knew some things, didn't know everything, then Aquila and Priscilla showed him the perfect way. Then he purposed, that is, Apollos purposed to go to Achaia, and the brethren with him wrote ahead of his going to receive him. And when he was received, he did a mighty work there. That's how things are done. That's what we need to strive for, brethren. All our other things will keep falling to death ears if we don't work to get the body united. The moment we focus on what's important to Yeshua, his priority, I pray that they may all be one. And in that oneness, everything else they're to do can be accomplished. Without that oneness, it cannot be accomplished. The testimony of the children of Israel with the tabernacle, with the priests. That's the testimony. Unless they are so united, nothing could be done. Nothing. The priests couldn't function. Nothing could function. The presence of them wouldn't be there. And then eventually, sadly, that's what actually happened later on because of their dissimulation and sins and self-contradiction. That's what happened. And this is kind of what's happening in the body for much too long. I understand. I know we all have personal likes, personal things that we think are important. But we have to put what Messiah says it's important. First, the unity of the body in him. Then the body can function. Without this unity, the body is a sick body and cannot function. Yeah, the body can be sick. We look at the letters of Messiah through John to the seven churches. Look how sick those congregations were, and look that some were relatively okay, but some were very ill and had stern warnings from Elohim, from Messiah, as to what to expect if they did not correct their issues. Today we have issues bigger than what any of those congregations have. Bigger. So let's find our brethren, unite with whoever wills, even if it's just 10 of us in all the world. Let it be so, for Elohim can do anything he wants with a few, with one or many. So don't worry, but let's do the work of uniting the body so we could function properly. Thank you for listening. Back to you, Brother Felix.
Yes, yes,
Jack Jackson.
Can you mute something so I can hear myself without the echo? See if that happens. All right, so let's proceed. Thank you, brother, for this portion here. Now we will hear a song. Will you tackle Brother Jackson the fifth month continuing, or?
Let's see what time it is.
108.
I guess I can go a little bit to just a quick review. And next Sabbath, which will be the ninth of Av, we could go over the Jerusalem, what happened to Jerusalem, what led up to it, to the destruction of Jerusalem.
Right. But are we still recording? I didn't think.
Yeah, it's still recording, but we will stop the recording now.